Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Andrea Blythe, co-host of New Books and Poetry, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we're speaking with Jason Biani about his new book, Locus. Jason is the author of both Locus from Omnidom Publishing in 2019 and Amulet from Right Bloody Publishing in 2013. He is an MFA graduate from St. Mary's College, a Kundiman Fellow, and works as the artistic director for the Kearney Street Workshop, the oldest multidisciplinary Asian Pacific American arts organization in the country. His publishing credits include World Literature Today, Muzzle Magazine, and Lantern Review, among others. Jason regularly performs around the country and debuted his solo theater show, Locus of Control, in 2016 with theatrical runs in San Francisco, New York, and Austin. Hi, Jason. Thank you for being on the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you. So generally, I like to kind of start at the beginning, and I would like to know a bit about how you started to connect with poetry.
You know, I didn't really have a lot of encouragement around writing. It was something early on, I think, that I was doing, but there was never any follow through. I was writing, participating in, you know, young author programs, and I even got an award like in fifth grade. But, you know, after that, you know, going to junior high, going to high school, I just was never, you know, found any further encouragement around it. And, you know, it just became something I never really thought of after that time until I went to college and at San Francisco State. And one of my English teachers, she just kind of pulled me aside one day, and she just asked me after, you know, she had read one of my assignments, and she said, "What's your major?" And I was like, I didn't have a major at the time because I went to SF State to run track. And so I told her I don't have one. And she just took me, she said, "Well, come with me." And then she took me to the creative writing office. And she said, "Well, here's your new major." And I was like, "Okay." And, you know, I was like 18 at the time. I didn't really know what was up. And I was just kind of like, that's fine. I that sounds like fun. And I was like writing. And next thing you know, I started off doing fiction. And, you know, then I got interested in theater. And like poetry was also this thing I was doing in the side. And, you know, I was just kind of experimenting with, I liked it. I liked, you know, reading poetry, but I was more focused on fiction and theater. But, you know, I was still writing poems, and I got involved with like a lot of local, you know, kind of Filipino activist groups at the time. And, you know, like spoken word was really kind of big in that scene. And I started doing that, like, you know, at events that I get invited to, and I started doing more and more. And then, yeah, I decided to go to my first poetry slam. And around like after I graduated college, and you know, I liked it. I didn't really want to keep doing theater anymore, but this kind of satisfied that part, you know, being able to perform. And you know, it was the after my first one in San Francisco. It was like this huge show they used to do at the Justice League. It was called the Justice League. It's now called the Independent. And there was like 200 people there. And, you know, I just got hooked. And, you know, I ended up finding out about the Berklee Poetry Slam. So I went to the Berklee Poetry Slam. And then once I got the Berklee Poetry Slam, this other person told me about their Poetry Slam. And there's one in Oakland, one in Vallejo, one in San Jose. And I just started going to all of them. Because I loved it and I wanted to keep doing it. And next thing you know, I started off like mostly like kind of doing spoken word and poetry. And the more I did it, the more like I kind of wanted to keep developing the craft.
Yeah. Poetry Slam is a very kind of, it's its own unique form of performance when it comes to reading poetry. Can you talk a little bit about the act of performance and what is it that you find valuable in the process of performance?
I think like Poetry Slam, I think gives you a form to work within, you know, and then, you know, it gives you like these 3 minutes that you're supposed to kind of create something. And then the more that you explore more poetry, you find other forms that you can fit within those 3 minutes. And I think even though it's free verse, we all adhere to some type of form when we write poetry. And, you know, being able to understand that even when I think I'm working without form, I'm creating a form at all times, that form always exists. And that really kind of like, you know, helped me to kind of understand my own poetry better, because I started to understand, like when I started looking at that, when I started seeing poetry as form, then you kind of start seeing what are the forms that you create. And I think that kind of furthered, you know, my exploration of form kind of further when I got my MFA and you know, working with Brendan Hillman, you know, just kind of got me seeing a lot more about like the different forms poetry takes. And you know, because I got to work, you know, within and explore many different types, you know, whether it's like sonnets or sestinas or what Poetry Slam gave me early on was you know, the understanding of poetry as form and how to work within one. And as far as the relevance of performance to me in my own poetry is that, you know, when I started in theater, one of my earliest professors there, just this amazing teacher, her name was Camille Howard. And she was the first professor I worked with in theater that really kind of showed me how to view language and oration and speaking and how to connect that to the body and how that, you know, what the thing, you know, what we write, what we, how we embody it. I mean, that connection, I never had considered that before. And so these are things that, you know, I learned early on that I continue to take with me throughout my development as a writer, that, you know, it all didn't like happen exactly the times that I received, you know, this information. But learning this early on, I believe, is what kind of helped me, you know, really develop who I was as both a poet and a performer.
You got your MFA. What drew you towards going for an MFA program, and what value did you get out of the program?
You know, when I got my MFA as an undergrad, I didn't really take school seriously during my undergrad. I mean, I was doing I was concentrating my MFA in my creative writing classes and, you know, the theater classes and stuff. But I mean, I was just kind of screwing around a lot, and I just undergrad, I think I was just having more fun than I was focusing on, you know, really working on my craft, you know, which is why I think a lot of what I learned then I didn't really receive till later on. And also I didn't really feel like, you know, during my undergrad, I was in my creative writing program, I felt kind of ignored. And, you know, that's why I had to find support in other places. But when I got to my MFA program, you know, I didn't take my MFA until I think I was 31. At the time. And I think having that distance between when I graduated undergrad to when I got my MFA really helped me personally, because I felt I was more in the space, you know, and I got to live a bit more of my life as a poet, as a writer, And, you know, to be able to come into, you know, an MFA program at this point in my life, I think I got a lot more out of it than I would have if I tried to go after I had graduated college. I think there was a lot more maturity I needed to go through. I needed to, I think, come more into my own as a writer and a poet before I could ever have an experience like that.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. That evolution as a person and a poet. Did the MFA program help you to get to your first book, or did that come separately?
Oh no, it definitely helped me get to my first book. I didn't even have anything together for manuscripts. I put out during my 20s, like everyone in Poetry Slam put out their own little chapbooks every so often, you know, because you do, you know, if you ever get featured sets, you need to have some type of product so you can make some money. So we always made these like little chapbooks at Kinko's, and, you know, or if we have friends that worked at a copy place, we go over there and just like try to get it hooked up. But I didn't really have an idea of like how to put a real manuscript together, and I didn't have the poems yet. And I think that going through the MFA program, I was able to not only like, I was able to like figure out what is my voice and what is it that I'm working towards. And to be able to look at the book is not just like this collection of like poetry you put together, but to be able to look at it as a book. You know, I'm just not throwing in years of work. Like nothing that exists in my first manuscript, in my first book, Amulet, everything that's in there is written. There's maybe only one poem I wrote in my 20s. Everything is from my MFA program to like maybe a year or two after my MFA program ended. So it's like a 4-year stretch of work that's in that book. And, a lot of that was just really kind of doing the work in the program of finding out who am I as a writer, and what direction do I want my poetry to you know head towards. And I these are things I didn't really consider, I think, in my 20s. You know, that I was a lot of times you're just kind of producing. You know, you're producing work, and a lot of it for me was like, I have a feeling, I have things inside of me, and I just need to get it out, and I just need to express it. And I think what I got out of my MFA was the ability to be able to now, okay, look at everything that came before and try to understand who I want to be as a poet.
That sounds like an interesting journey and process, the self-exploration through the act of writing. So how did you come to Locus? What was your process for writing that book?
I think after the first book came out, I was in a very similar position as I'm in right now, where like I was like, I don't want to write anything, you know. You know, the book came, you know, I maybe wrote one or two poems here and there. And I was living in Austin, Texas at the time when the book came out. And I had decided to move back home to the Bay Area. And, you know, I was going through a lot at the time. And it was just kind of, I spent maybe when I came back the first 2 years just trying to put a book together. But I didn't know what that book was. And every time I kept putting poems together, you know, I had met another amazing poet, Brent Saito, and we had kind of started pushing each other to write more. And we'd share these Google Docs every so often and do like a 30 poems in 30 day Google Doc. You know, we just kind of like would just post something. We'd at least try to put up 30 poems within 30 days. We didn't always get there, but I mean, like, it was good to just produce work. And I started envisioning what would an entire book for me look like that would be based around a common theme, or would work around a common theme. And, you know, I had an idea of maybe like exploring the idea of cities. And I thought about maybe writing a whole book that was chronological, and each poem marked the year of my life. And I was trying to work within all these different ideas, and nothing was quite coming together. And I was starting to get frustrated. And, so I decided to, there was this grant from the Asian Pacific Islander Cultural Center the applications were coming up, and I decided to apply for it. And I thought, I do these 30-minute shows, all the time whenever I'm asked to do a feature. Like, what would it look like if I tried to do an hour-long show? I was thinking, stand-up comedians do this. They do their 5, 10, 20-minute sets, and then they go for their Netflix special. It'd be like an hour. And I thought maybe I could do something similar. So I applied for the grant, and that was my idea. And I thought, I have all these poems. I don't know what to do with it. Maybe I'll just turn it into this show. And so I got the grant, and I decided to turn it into a solo show. And that show, I premiered in 2016. I started working with this theater artist who's also a stand-up comedian. Her name is Catavasco. And, I worked with her because she did kind of similar thing. She was doing stand-up and turned her stand-up into a one-hour solo theater show. I thought, she'd be great to work with. And she really kind of helped me out in conceptualizing what this story would look like, how to take my poems and just kind of connect them together through storytelling, through, music and multimedia. And since 2016, I was developing the show to be this cohesive look at, using my poetry, using storytelling at what my Filipino-American, Filipino experience in America has been. And to work within the idea of story as Filipinos in America, what is that, what is that story? Can my perspective help to tell that story amongst other perspectives? And in doing so, for me, it's in this, what you hope to kind of do is not only claim ownership of what the Filipino and Filipino American story is, or claim some part of that, but also to be able to have a say in what the American story is. And that was the idea of what, the show would be, a way of using the individual story to tell the greatest story. And, once that show was set in place, I was able to kind of return to the manuscript and, use what I had done with the show and build upon that to flesh those ideas out even further, kind of, this exploration of, one Filipino American story and how it opens up, what these greater narratives mean. And that's what the book became.
Yeah. Wow. It's an interesting way of kind of, coming back around to the book by exploring a different form of approaching it. There's parts of this book that feel very much like memoir, like exploring personal childhood and family, particularly between brothers and cousins. And can you talk a bit about pulling from your personal experience to kind of try to share a wider experience? I don't know if that's the right way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best I can do is be able to tell what my experience is. I think that I like to see art working in tandem with the work of historians. And I think that growing up, when a lot of the people I knew growing up from college have become these amazing, academic historians in the world. There's folks I met in college who are just really kind of they are, you know, when we talk about like academic historians, you know, they are the people we talk about. And you know, folks like Alison Tintiago Kubales and the late Don Mabalan, who passed away last year. I mean, I remember hanging out with them and, you know, and remember when they used to do spoken word, and now they're like, you know, they're like these super respected professors, and it's great to see. And I've always worked alongside that. I've always worked like, you know, coming up, my poetry and literary experience was around like Filipino activism, and so, you know, yeah, and I believe that for a person of color, you know, to create art is a means of us being able to obtain agency over our narratives, and the ability to obtain agency over our narratives, over our stories, is an intensely political act, especially because our stories have been constantly told, you know, for us instead of by us. And that's why I think that, like, you know, I was looking at this book. It's just like, you know, I think I tried to explain it over again. This is just one part. And, you know, I see myself working in tandem, in conversation with the work being done by, you know, so many Filipino artists and academics in the U.S. right now. And I even look like, you know, this idea of like this memoir style of poetics. Like, I'm not the only one doing it. I mean, like, you know, there's Jenna Sapigao, who works in similar fashion, and told kind of like a history of, you know, the Filipino experience in the Silicon Valley in a similar way. Jason Magabo Perez also is another person that, you know, from Southern California, who wrote his last book, This Is For The Most, this works in that prose and poetry style. I've talked to Amy Cesara, who's another amazing poet from the Bay, who's also kind of working in the prose and poetry style. And that, you know, one of my favorite albums from last year is by a Panay rapper named Ruby Ibarra, who wrote an entire album, which is like, it's rap memoir. It is that lyric memoir style. And it's an entire album that does that. And I think like it's kind of dope that there's this like synergy happening, you know, at this time, and that like, and I look at it, it is this kind of way or this kind of means of by which we're all working together to kind of grab a hold of our narrative, especially as like we become, as Filipinos, like this bigger presence in the United States.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's interesting that you mentioned hip hop or rap, because music is spoken about quite a bit throughout your book. Can you talk a bit about the importance of music to you and how it's influenced your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that music is what, you know, growing up, like, you don't, I think it's hard for me to explain to people, like, how you grow up in this country without any sense, without anything that reflects back to you. So you're kind of like this thing that exists in America, but doesn't exist in America. And, you know, I think that's where you kind of latch on to other cultures to kind of find a way through to a way to be, you know, finding your way through the way to be you. And a lot of that, I think, you know, can become appropriation, but a lot of it is also, this is what we had coming into here in the 80s and early 90s without anything that reflected us. You know, we looked at like other communities that were around us at the time. Because the thing is that if one thing that was painfully obvious is that we weren't white. And so, you know, the closest communities to us were either like Mexican communities or Black communities. And I think in engaging, you know, with those cultures, you know, helped us find a way back and be able to create one of our own. And a lot of the ways we engage with other cultures were through music, you know, in hip hop. And also even like R&B music, I found this means of being able to express an otherness in isolation and that you know, you feel in America, but don't know how to express, don't know how to put into words. And there is a thing that you want to rail against, but you don't know what that is yet. I think that's why, like, I have such a embedded connection, you know, to the music I grew up with, because it allowed me to access, you know, the feelings I didn't understand and begin to formulate, you know, some way of talking about them. Whether it's like, you know, I mean, like I think about like, you know, my political identity, or the being able to even, you know, start to create a language around how to talk about oppression and how to talk about culture. And a lot of that came from the hip hop I was listening to, you know. That's why it's always, you know, going to be, you know, special to me. I think the feeling, you know, the different emotional buttons that music can kind of like tap into you, you know, even though I can't always express what it means, I know what the feeling is, and it's returning to those feelings. It's returning to, you know, whatever pushes and moves inside of me that I continue to think, I continue to explore the things that I write. Yeah,
I think that's beautiful. Would you like to read one of your poems from the collection?
Sure. So this is this one's called Tambo, which is like this little bucket that you have to use in the outhouses whenever you gotta use the bathroom. On Tatang's farm, he grabs a bucket of water and heads to the outhouse at midnight. The tread of his footsteps slapping the bucket's fill against the insides, the way it sways, curling back into its container. Maybe one of his sons wakes up. Even the subtlest of sounds is a violent disruption in all this perfect quiet. My father is not here. Only the boys who are old and strong enough are needed, and there isn't enough to feed them all. The last boy will go to school. The last boy will live with his aunt, who has enough to make sure he's fed. This is how you start an education, how you learn to live without attachments, what you will need to know to leave the country where you were born. My grandfather trudges along the night. An errant drop flies at the backswing and lands on the dirt, taking within only a small container of the moon. This drop, once whole, once familiar, having to learn to be something new. And maybe it thinks, how will I recognize myself? Who will I be? This far away from where I was home.
Well, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
I think that ties into my next question, which is a bit about identity, the way that poem wraps up about who I will be and that sort of thing. And there's a poem near the beginning of your book that repeats the phrase, always I am told I am nothing, and from nothing I make myself material. And it's in broken lines across the page, and that phrase is repeated multiple times with different spacing. And it's very powerful in the midst of all these and connecting with the rest of the poetry. So I would love if you talked a bit about this concept of nothingness and identity and creating yourself. And it also makes me wonder if poetry is a way of making oneself more material.
Yeah, I think that growing up, I constantly felt like I don't exist here, you know? And it's a strange thing because I have flesh and I have blood and I have this body, but I don't exist in this place. And I still feel that often, no matter like what I've done with my life, that here I'm still a blank space. And it's always been this fight to make me be something here. And I think, I wonder a lot of times if I wasn't a poet, if I wasn't a writer, would I always feel that in some way, you know, that what are the things that would make me feel whole? And if I never tried to understand how my existence here as a Filipino played into that, if I never thought about that, if I just tried to assimilate, you know, and be a quote unquote good minority, you know, would I be able to not feel that? Or would that always be this pervasive thing that eats away at me? You know, this life, being a writer, has been one of constant self-examination and is giving me the tools to do that. It's given me it gave me the courage to seek therapy. It gave me a way to talk about what I feel and what I believe and what I hope for. And expressing any of these things in my life, it's never easy. I still struggle with all of it, but I feel having this gift that was, you know, because it's not, I don't want to use the term gift as a gift, like I have this gift for poetry, but this gift that was, but it is, to have this in my life was a gift, you know, to have poetry, to be allowed to be one, is a gift for me. And because it gave me all these things. And even if I'm not always happy, I could find ways to be happy. I could find the means to work through all of it. And so, yeah, you know, that nothing, that's something that gets made from nothing. Yeah, a lot of that has to do with poetry. A lot of that happened because poetry gave me back a way to find my culture, my history, a way to understand my parents better, a way to understand my people better. And I feel more whole because of it.
That's a powerful thing. There's all these things that you mentioned that poetry was able to give to you. I mean, do you think beyond being able to give voice to people who, in a way that they might not have been able to before, is there a role that poetry plays in society in terms of helping to spark discussion or create change?
I want to believe that's the case. And, you know, I've seen, you know, poetry reach folks that, like, even if they don't feel like maybe it's accessible to them. But I'm still in a lot of ways trying to figure out, like, is this something that needs to be actively pursued? How do we, is it important? Like, I wonder, Because it's this whole idea of making like of the accessibility of poetry and the questions we have around the accessibility of poetry. How do we, and I'm just trying to figure out the best way maybe to, we can't worry about, you know, I mean, like, you know, to be able to push the art, we can't worry about what, you know, we can't worry about whether or not what you make is going to be accessible. But I also feel like I think we can trust people more to understand, you know, what the function of poetry is if they're given the opportunity. And also that it is, you know, once it's demystified for them a little more, that they, yeah, like even a poem that needs work, that it is accessible to any of us. If we just kind of like take the time to sit with things, take the time to be curious about language, to be curious about the ways in which we communicate with one another, and to also like be actively wanting to question and to explore. And I think that a lot of that is missing. You know, I think people want to, a lot of the times, be to say and be correct and you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It's, there's this certainty, you know, in people about things, and it doesn't make sense to me because I'm rarely ever certain about a lot of things, and I don't understand how people can always be so certain that everything they say or do or think or feel is the correct thing. I mean, like, you know, I think there are certain things we should believe are correct and real and certain. But like, I mean, I think there, especially when it's things around like racism or the fact that like we are experiencing climate change.
Yes, yes.
But like, I think we should be certain about that. But I mean.
But emotional experience.
Yeah.
Spiritual experience.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's, I wish to see more curiosity out of people. And that's, you know, because I'm always curious. I think curious gives you the capacity for wonder. And, you know, I always tell people this, I'm a very cynical person, you know, but, you know, again, what poetry gives me is the ability to access my curiosity. And that curiosity leads me to my wonder. And that's, for me, that's what I love in seeing in poetry.
Yeah, me too. I've definitely read poems where I've not fully understood the message behind them, but it opens up ways to be okay with that uncertainty of understanding and just experience the language and the emotion behind it. So you mentioned that now that this book is finished, that you're not necessarily wanting to be working on writing at the moment. So normally I ask what you're working on now, but if it's not writing, what might that be, or what are you doing with your time now that the book's done?
I mean, like I still work as an artistic director for an amazing arts organization here in San Francisco. You know, we're currently, like, around this time of the year is when we have our festival Aperture, which is a festival for emerging Asian Pacific American artists in the Bay Area. It's a multidisciplinary festival with visual arts, literary, music, and it's music, performing arts, comics, illustration, all this stuff. And we have 6 different showcases that happen in October. And so, like, I'm working on that. And I still perform. I'm still doing Locus of Control. You know, I'll be doing Sacramento coming up in October, October 19th, at the Guild Theater out there. I still want to develop that a little more. I'm thinking about a different theater show. And I've been thinking about maybe working on some fiction or, you know, maybe like exploring more options in theater. But I probably will be writing poems soon enough. Yeah.
So to wrap up, I generally like to ask if you would share something that you've been reading or some form of media that you've been loving at the moment and that, or something that you find inspiring.
You know, I this I've been really trying to explore a lot of work of Filipino artists in the last month or two. I just finished two books by Randy Rebay and Gina Apostle, and those are amazing. But one thing I do want to talk about is last night I finally got around. There's this young Filipino artist from Bay Area who now lives in LA. Her name is Jay Som, and she kind of does indie dream pop, like shoegaze type music. And I listened to it last night, and it moved me so much, you know, listening to this album, because it was, when I think about the art being made by Filipinos in America, and what it looked like when I was younger, you know, to what it looked like now and how varied and assured and unique the styles have become. I think about kind of like the lineage of like Filipino kind of dream pop shoegaze acts that I kind of like knew when I was in my early 20s. Bands like Julie Plug and Skyflakes and to see like Jay Som is this kind of like work in that lineage and how it has become this extension of that to something that just entirely like it's an album that is so realized and understands what it wants to be. And it's beautiful, and it's just there's so much I feel that you put into that album. I love it, and I think it's like it's definitely like something I woke up this morning, I kept listening to it. It's so great. It's called a Nako, which means you know, a Nako is what you know, what we call child. It's kind of like a Nako, you know, child of mine, and it's great.
That sounds amazing. I am definitely going to have to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you so much for this really amazing conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. All righty. So if you, our listeners, would like to discuss this episode with me, one of the places that you can do so is on Shuffle. It's a new ad-free social media network that's centered around engaging conversation. And I personally love the use of categorization so that I can zero in on the things I'm passionate about. Shuffle is invite-only at the moment. And if you would like to join, you can go to www.shuffle.do/nbn/join. That's www.shuffle.do/nbn/join. And I'll also put a link in the show notes. So thank you so much for listening. I wish you all a wonderful day and some amazing poetry to enjoy. And this is New Books and Poetry, a podcast channel of the New Books Network.